I'm Marty Moscowane. Welcome to Radio Times. President Reagan famously said, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem. President Biden clearly believes the opposite, that government is the solution to today's economic problems hit hard by the pandemic. And by government, we're talking about the $1.9 trillion American Rescue Plan passed by the House and Senate awaiting Biden's signature. It includes $1,400 in stimulus checks for most Americans, extended unemployment benefits, expanded child tax credits, tax forgiveness for jobless benefits and student loan debts. There are billions for state and local governments, for vaccines and testing programs, for opening schools and restaurants, and that's a partial list. Democratic Congressman Pete Aguilar said it was the boldest action taken on behalf of the American people since the Great Depression. Republican Steve Scalise called it a socialist agenda, complaining you can't just keep adding mountains of debt at hundreds of billions at a time. Well, we're going to dissect those numbers and discuss the impact on you and the overall economy. And let me introduce our two guests. Emily Stewart is business and politics reporter for Vox. And Emily, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Leonard Berman. He's the Paul Volcker Professor at Syracuse University, co-founder of the Tax Policy Center, and co-author of a book called Taxes in America, What Everyone Needs to Know. And Len Berman, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Let me play a clip from last night before we get into our conversation. This is President Biden in a statement last night announcing his intention to sign the COVID relief bill. He's going to do that tomorrow, but also talking about how recovery for the pandemic and the economy are linked.
This bill represents a historic victory for the American people. I look forward to signing it later this week. Everything in the American Rescue Plan addresses a real need, including investments to fund our entire vaccination effort, more vaccines, more vaccinators, and more vaccination sites. Millions more Americans will get tested, including home testing. Schools will soon have the funding and resources to reopen safely, a national imperative. The American Rescue Plan, the partnership between Johnson & Johnson and Merck, proves we can do big things, important things in this country.
Let me begin with you. Is this a kind of new deal on the same level of what FDR did?
Well, it's different from the New Deal because most of it only lasts for 1 year. The New Deal went for the duration of the Great Depression, and some of the elements of the New Deal, like Social Security, are with us even now. It is a major change from the way we've dealt with economic downturns in the past. It's a huge economic stimulus, and we've never really tested putting enough money into the economy to actually fill the gap left by the crippled economy. So it'll be interesting to see how it plays out. A lot of people think it's too big, but it certainly looks like it's big enough.
Well, Emily, let me turn to you. And it's interesting to compare it to what the Trump administration did last year, or even going back more than a decade to what Obama did in relation to the financial crisis. Can you kind of compare and contrast some of these attempts to rescue the U.S. economy?
Sure. So if you go back to the Great Recession, this is comparable to what was done back in 2009, but it is quite a bit bigger. In thinking in terms of GDP, it's about double the GDP of that. Back in 2009, it was about 5% of 2008's GDP. Now it's about 9% of 2020's GDP. So it's quite large. And this is something the Democrats have been seeing for quite some time when you talk to them about the bill, that they feel like in 2009, they kind of undershot it. And so this time they really want to overshoot it. And take a big swing here, which they did.
Clearly. I mean, Len, I guess time will tell. Do you agree, though, with those people or perhaps economists that said what Obama did was too small and that they needed to right size it?
Well, it's certainly true that the bill passed in the legislation in 2008 was too small. It was not entirely President Obama's fault, even. It took us 10 years to recover from the Great Recession. We basically just just made up the loss in productivity when the COVID recession hit us. So I think most economists agree we needed to do more. The debate is about exactly how much should be done and how it should be done.
Well, and it's interesting. I'll toss this back to you, Len, but it's interesting. I mean, we're dealing with a massive healthcare crisis that obviously is very tied into an economic crisis because people can't go to work and, you know, all the things that we have lived through, frankly, in the last year.
Yeah, and certainly a big part of recovering from this recession is getting people healthy, getting them vaccinated, making it safe for people to be able to go back to work, and also making sure that businesses are still operating by the time people are ready to go back to work. One of the big concerns about this recession is how many restaurants, tourism businesses, other small businesses have failed over the last year.
And whether they can come back or whether they will come back.
Or be replaced by something else. Yeah, right. I mean, I think this bill has a lot of help for businesses that have been struggling and are still holding on. And the question is, what's going to go into all those empty storefronts once the economy gets going again? I'm optimistic that there will be a lot of demand for restaurants and other business services, actually pent-up demand from people being stuck in their homes for the last year. And the question is whether there are people that have the resources to start up new businesses to replace the ones that have failed.
Emily, let me go to you and let me go to the $1,400 stimulus checks, which most Americans will get. Help us understand what some of the debate was about and whether we know when these checks will be sent out and some of the nitty gritty there.
Sure. So the checks are going to be $1,400, and basically they will go to everybody who makes up to $75,000 a year. Now, where the debate has been around the phase out and at what point people are deemed to have made enough money that they shouldn't get one of these checks. And so initially the phase out was set at $100,000 in income tied to either their 2019 income or if they had filed their taxes 2020. Now the checks are going to phase out at $80,000. So that's a lot narrower. I do think it's important to note that this is the first time that stimulus checks will be going to adult dependents, meaning college kids or maybe elderly people that live with their children. And so some people will be getting checks that didn't before. In terms of timing, it seems like it's pretty soon. People might be seeing those checks in their bank accounts over the next couple of weeks.
And back to you, Len, the child tax credit, that seems to be almost the most dramatic part of this plan or this bill that will be signed by the president in terms of actually addressing the problem of poverty in this country. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, it's actually a major expansion. There are two things that they did. One is they increased the maximum credit by $1,000 for most kids, and $1,600 for children under the age of six. They also increased the age by 1 year for kids who are eligible. The second thing is they made the full credit refundable. Under the previous law, the maximum amount of credit you could get if you didn't have other tax liability was $1,400 per child.
Right.
And this will say the full $3,000 or $3,600 would go to families regardless of their tax liability. So, you know, there are some estimates that would cut child poverty in the year in which this is in effect by half.
By
That's
half.
Pretty significant. Yeah.
Which tells you when you give low-income people money, you cut poverty. I mean, is it just that simple, Len?
Yeah, I mean, that one salient feature of poor people is they don't have much money.
Right, right. So you give them money and then they're not poor. Do you want to speak to that, Emily?
Yeah, I mean, I do think that this is kind of really the biggest and, to me, one of the most exciting parts of this bill is looking at where the money is going. You can look at charts kind of comparing it to the tax cuts Republicans passed back in 2017. And we know that those really did really benefit the wealthy and corporations. And you look at this and it's like, you know, a lot of the money and a lot of the benefit is going to people at the lower end of the income scale and at the lowest end of the income scale. And we also know that those people, when they get the money, they spend it. They don't save it, which might be good for the overall economy. You know, they're not tossing into their bank accounts. They're paying their rent.
Let me read an email from Beverly. She says support for children of low-income families is a very good thing. However, she asks, why would families making $150,000 need $3,000 for children over six or $3,600 for children under six of our tax dollars for children that they have chosen to have? I mean, is there an argument, Len, to say that this is too generous for some people?
It's surely more than some people need to support their families. I think the logic behind this proposal is that if you make it available to most people, I think it's like 90% of kids would be eligible for an increase in credits. It doesn't have the stigma of looking like welfare. It's not just targeted at poor people who people might identify as different from them. And it might be more popular and more sustainable over the long run. I think one reason why Social Security is probably the most popular program the federal government runs is that everybody benefits from it, at least to some extent, as long as they worked. So that's the logic behind it. But Beverly has a point. There are a lot of families who are going to get money from this package that don't really need help. They've actually been doing well during the recession, and their incomes are high enough that they can meet their needs.
Are we, though, Len, getting closer to universal basic income or some version of that?
I'm sure there are people who hope that's the case. And it's you have us back in a couple of years, we'll have more information about whether this is a one-time blip or whether it's just a sea change in the way we provide support to families.
Let me pick up on that, Emily, about a minute before our first break here. But there is a question, and as Len said, a lot of this is temporary. But the question is, especially with a child tax credit, people are going to like it, and it's going to be most people in this country, and whether it'll become sort of like Social Security, become just sort of a regular part of our economy, or whether it disappears. Any thoughts about that before our break?
I mean, I do think it's certainly the hope among many people that the child tax credit will stick. I guess we have to kind of wait and see what happens, but I don't think there's any denying that there is a real hope that this is going to stick around and become a more permanent part of American life.
And hope coming from Democrats, progressives, UBI people?
Yeah.
Andrew Yang.
Democrats, progressives, yes, Andrew Yang sort of like this. But, maybe I think, as Len said, maybe as more people start to get this, there's probably some Republicans who are going to be just fine with this as well.
Well, let's take that short break. And that's Emily Stewart. She is business and politics reporter for Vox. Leonard Berman is the Paul Volcker Professor at Syracuse University and co-founder of the Tax Policy Center, also co-author of a book called Taxes in America, What Everyone Needs to Know. And we are talking about the $1.9 trillion American Rescue Plan. President Biden is going to sign it tomorrow, and then he and members of his administration are going to fan out across the country and sell it to the American people. You can join us, Radio Times, at WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. President Biden is ready to sign the $1.9 trillion COVID-19 relief bill, also known as the American Rescue Plan. It includes $1,400 in direct checks, money for jobless benefits, money for state and local governments, much, much more, although no increase in the minimum wage. And if you want to join our conversation, again, you can send us an email. RadioTimes@WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call us 1-888-477-9499. And this is your tax money that's going out to the American people. Lynn, let me go to you, and even going back to last year when the Trump administration and the Congress then sent out checks of $1,200. How did Americans spend that money, or did they spend that money? Did they save it? What did they do with it?
I think a lot of the money actually was saved. I haven't seen statistics. I think it's going to be a while before we collect data that we could use to measure that. But savings rate over the last year has grown pretty dramatically, and particularly for families that kept their jobs and actually had lower costs because they couldn't go to restaurants or do other things, they were able to or even kind of forced to save more money. So one thing that happens even in normal recessions is that a significant chunk of the money goes to paying down credit card debt or other things. So it doesn't get spent right away. That's one reason why some economists think that flooding the economy with cash might be a good idea, because some of it won't be spent.
Isn't it, though, a good thing? I mean, to pay down credit card debt, knowing how, you know, astronomical those interest rates are, or even building up people's savings account. We know that Americans don't save very much, in part because so many of them don't make a lot of money. But isn't that a good thing for the economy?
Over the long run, it is a good thing. Although, you know, at the same time that private balance sheets are improving, the public balance sheet is further deteriorating. It doesn't concern me right now. The biggest concern is getting the economy going again, getting people back to work. But over the long term, our rising debt levels, particularly if we continue to do what we were doing even before the recession, which is just borrowing like crazy to pay for things like tax cuts for rich people or other things that aren't huge priorities in the short run, that over the long run, the growing public debt could be a problem. That said, if people have more money saved, they'll be in a better position, or if they have less debt themselves,
right,
they'll be in a better position to handle whatever comes down the road, particularly if it's like higher taxes or less government spending.
Emily, let me go back to you. And what isn't in here is an increase in the federal minimum wage. This was, I don't know how big the battle was, but help us understand why this didn't make the cut.
Sure. So there was hope that there would be an increase in the federal minimum wage, which is currently at $7.25 an hour, to $15 an hour by 2025. So it's important to note that this was going to be phased in. It didn't mean that, businesses were going to have to pay $15 tomorrow.
Right.
But it did make it into the House bill, and then the Senate parliamentarian ruled that it could not go in the Senate bill because they passed it through a process called budget reconciliation, and the parliamentarian said, this can't go here, basically. We did see some Democrats try and get it put back in the bill, and that amendment failed because multiple Democrats voted against it. And so I think this is something that is certainly not going away, but it's become quite clear that there isn't a consensus, at least among Democrats in the Senate, about what the minimum wage should be.
Do you see it, though, coming back in another form? There are clearly most Republicans, or maybe all Republicans, oppose it, but there are some Democrats. Joe Manchin comes to mind, who do oppose this idea of raising the federal minimum wage to 15.
Yeah, I mean, this is something that a lot of activists have been working on for a long time, and they're certainly not giving up. And I think it is hard to argue that $7.25 is a living wage in maybe any part of the country. And so Manchin and a lot of others have said, okay, maybe I'm not on board with 15, but I could get on board with something like a 10, 11, 12, whatever. And that's a conversation that certainly I think will keep going.
How do you see that? I mean, Linda, is it time, as an economist, should we increase the federal minimum wage?
Yes, but probably not to $15 an hour.
No.
The Congressional Budget Office estimated that it would reduce employment, or it would cause 1.7 million people to lose their jobs. So it'd be kind of like a lottery. A whole bunch of people would be much better off the $15 wage, but there'd be probably the people with the lowest skills or people living in places like West Virginia where wages are very low who wouldn't be able to find jobs. And that's a problem. I actually have a paper where I propose a very large wage credit to try to that would get people up to a living wage and beyond. And that in combination with a somewhat a higher minimum wage than we currently have, but maybe not a national $15 wage, would make low and middle income people much, much better off. But it's it's a reasonable debate. The problem is it's not, you know, you'd like to think that we had an economy where everyone could earn enough to live on, but it's not what we have now. The other thing is, you know, if you could improve people's skills and training, help them to, you know, work in high-tech jobs that pay better, that's a much better, much more sustainable approach to raising people with people's wages over the long term. And the other thing is just keeping the economy healthy. You know, right. The wages were going up before COVID hit. And if we can keep from this cycle of boom and bust, that would be a huge boon for low-income people.
But do you think, Len, that the pandemic has revealed these, you know, these deep inequities in our economic system, and that you've got, you know, well-off people who are actually probably even better off because of the economy, and then you've got so many people struggling in the middle, and then you've got people who are just, you know, waiting in food lines at the bottom, who have jobs and are in food lines at the bottom of the scale?
Right. You're absolutely right about that. I mean, the economic inequality has been growing markedly over time, and the stock market has been booming at the same time that millions of people have lost their jobs. I don't think is whether inequality is a problem. The question is, what's the most effective way to help low and middle income people? And I think a higher minimum wage is part of it, but I don't think that it can carry the entire load by itself, just because there's a risk that a lot of people would end up losing their jobs and be worse off.
Emily, even looking at this American Rescue Plan, do you see it as an attempt to at least address some of these inequities, maybe on a temporary basis? But the fact that so much of the money, frankly, goes to people at the lower end of the income scale.
Yeah, I mean, we know that kind of what has happened in the pandemic is that people who are at the top of the income scale are doing better, and people at the bottom are not. And so whether that means getting money to unemployed workers, which this does, right? It expands unemployment insurance, which is something that happened under the CARES Act. Like, it helps people who can't pay their rent. There's a specific fund for restaurants, which we know they have been hit very hard because there are many places they have not been allowed to be open. And so this does feel like this is taking a look at some of the places that we really needed some help and making sure that they get that help.
Let me just quickly reintroduce the two of you. That's Emily Stewart. She's business and politics reporter for Vox. Leonard Berman with us as well. He's the Paul Volcker Professor at Syracuse University, co-founder of the Tax Policy Center, and co-author of a book called Taxes in America, What Everyone Needs to Know. And we are talking about the American Rescue Plan. It made it through the Senate over the weekend. It was passed by the House yesterday. No Republicans voted for it, and Joe Biden, President Biden, is going to sign it tomorrow. He's also going to be speaking to the country tonight, and we are talking about what's in the bill, what it took to get it passed, how it could, maybe would, or will change the U.S. economy, and, of course, its impact on you. And you can join us, Radio Times, at WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Tom asks, and Emily, I'll put this to you, are there any cuts to Medicare in the bill? I mean, are there any cuts to anything in the bill?
I mean, I don't believe so. I don't know what they'd be cutting in here. I do think, like, there is some good stuff on the healthcare stuff in general. We do see where basically the bill's going to cover COBRA, so for people who lose their jobs completely, which is great. If anybody's lost their job, you know that sometimes paying for your health insurance afterwards is very difficult. And it also does increase subsidies on Obamacare for a couple of years. So that is some areas where it's going to help.
There are a few tax increases that are built into it.
What are they?
There's a provision to deny the deduction for compensation in excess of $1 million. It's basically aimed at reducing economic inequality. I think looking at
you're looking at it as we speak, right?
I mean, there's so many.
I can hear you reading. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking at the Joint Committee on Taxation score for this thing, but there's $23 billion from a change in the way employers can write off their expenses for pension contributions, other stuff that right. I don't even know what the details are. But over the long run, the bill actually raises a little bit of money, assuming that the tax credits and other things aren't made permanent.
Interesting. Now, I think it was you, Emily, that I was reading. So since the pandemic, and today is kind of the official start of the pandemic when the WHO made their announcement, I believe the U.S. government has spent $4.4 trillion. I don't know if that includes the American Rescue Plan or just what happened under the Trump administration. First of all, do I have those numbers? Are they correct, Emily?
I think this adds to it.
So this adds to it. So we're talking about almost more than $6 trillion.
We're talking about a lot of money.
We're talking about a lot of money, which makes me want to ask you, Lynn, and there are concerns about just, you know, is the government spending too much money? Is there a line? And we already carry a lot of debt. Is there a line in which debt becomes unsustainable? I know that the interest rates are really low, so that makes borrowing seem very attractive. But nonetheless, is there a point at which we're just spending too much money that we don't have?
Yes, we don't know where that point is. I mean, the thing is, borrowing money to keep us from being wallowed in recession or depression for a decade is a good investment. It might actually improve the budget situation compared with doing nothing. Borrowing money to invest in infrastructure and things like that, education, might also make sense. The concern I have and some other economists have is that we've also been borrowing money to pay for, you know, current spending. A lot of the tax cut bills that we've enacted over the last 20 or 30 years have been put in place not to boost the economy, at least in the short run, but because there was a thought that people were paying too much in taxes, which might be true, but you know, if you want to cut taxes, you also should identify the spending you're going to eliminate to keep from bloating the debt. But the concern is that, you know, with interest rates at like 1 or 2%, we can borrow a lot of money and not have it be a serious problem. If interest rates went up in the future back to the levels they were at 30 or 40 years ago, that could be and particularly if the debt has grown to the point where it's like 2 or 3 times the size of the economy, that could be disastrous.
And when you look at the Trump tax cuts of a couple of years ago, Lynn, do we know what the actual sort of price tag was for those tax cuts?
Yeah, those are about $1.9 trillion, too.
Okay, so we're talking similar amounts of money.
Yeah. And, you know, there's just been this growing disconnect between what the government is spending, which has been trending up just because of aging. Got more people on Social Security claiming Medicare, having Medicaid pay for their long-term care, and taxes, which have been pushed down mostly by Republican Congresses and administrations. And the problem is that dealing with the main drivers of spending, Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, will be really politically unpopular and difficult. Telling seniors you're not going to pay for all their health care, or telling people who depend on Social Security that they're not going to get as much in the way of benefits, would be a really hard sell to the American public. So basically, we've done what the small government people want. We've done half of it, which we said we'll cut taxes a lot. And there's a theory among some conservatives called starve the beast, that if you just cut taxes, eventually you'll have to cut spending because the budget numbers are so bad. The concern is that if you basically stop the connection between tax revenues and the amount the government's spending, people just get the sense, well, more spending is free, so give me more programs and keep on cutting my taxes and everything will be great, until it's not.
Interesting. Emily, let me go back to you. This is more a political question. No Republicans in either the Senate or the House voted for this American Rescue Plan. Do you think there are political risks? Since apparently, at least by all measures that I've seen, it is popular among the American people. And I know that Biden and et al. Are going to be out there really promoting the hell out of this thing. But do you think there's some political risk for them?
For Republicans?
Yeah.
For
Republicans.
I mean, it's hard to say. Like, that is just sometimes hard to make that connection to people. I think it is true that this is a very popular bill. It's also true, like, if you ask the average person whether or not their senator or congressperson voted for it, they might not know. But Democrats are certainly going to try to make this an issue. And, like, I think that ultimately it comes down to if over the next couple of years people do notice that their lives are better, we're going to have to wait and see. Obviously, Democrats maybe under traditional thinking would not do super well in the midterms. Like, do we know what will happen next year? No. But it does seem like, again, this is a really popular bill, and it's just a question, I think, of whether Democrats could really make that connection for voters.
We're almost having a break here. Lynn, you're an economist. Do you want to weigh in on this at all?
I think the risks to both sides. Biden and the Democrats own this. And if the economy roars back to full employment and people feel better off, then I assume that would work out well for the Democrats. If the economy stalls, if the debt levels keep on going up and Republicans do a good job of painting this as creeping socialism that's a risk to our republic, that'll be a problem for the Democrats. And like everything else, we won't know for another couple of years how it plays out.
Well, let's take that short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Leonard Berman. He's the Paul Volcker Professor at Syracuse University. As I said earlier, co-founder of the Tax Policy Center, co-author of a book called Taxes in America, What Everyone Needs to Know. Emily Stewart is business and politics reporter for Vox. We are talking about the $1.9 trillion American Rescue Plan that will be signed by President Biden tomorrow. We're going to take a short break. Much more after this break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow. And just a recap here, especially if you are just joining our conversation, the Biden administration's massive stimulus bill was approved by the House of Representatives yesterday. It's now headed for the White House for President Biden's signature, which he will do tomorrow. And he is speaking to the nation tonight. It's a hugely ambitious package of policies and relief measures with a huge price tag of $1.9 trillion. It includes stimulus checks for most Americans, unemployment checks for those out of a job, child tax credits, relief for student loans, money for state and local governments, and much, much more. And while these measures are largely designed to address the COVID-19 crisis, they do seem to signal a big government approach to the economy. And again, talking to Vox reporter Emily Stewart and Tax Policy Institute co-founder, economist Leonard Berman. Leonard, I want to go back to you and go back to the money that is earmarked or targeted for more low-income Americans. One of the things that you told John Ahrens in preparation for the show is that a lot of low-income workers are not banked, in that they don't use banks in the way that maybe more middle-class or even upper-class people do. And in terms of getting them what's in this plan, how can we address that problem?
So I think in the first round of stimulus, the Treasury Department actually sent out like bank, prepaid debit card, prepaid bank cards to households that didn't have a bank account. There are things you can do to reach the people that don't file tax returns or don't get their refunds automatically deposited in a bank account.
Right.
But it is actually, it's another, you asked about inequity before. And one way in which our economy is very uneven is that there are a lot of people that don't have access to the financial system. And if they just get a check, they might have to pay somebody a lot of money to just to cash it and turn it into cash. So that's something I'm sure the IRS will be working on. But they are aware of this problem, and they're doing everything they can to make sure they can reach everyone who's eligible.
And Emily, President Biden is not going to sign these checks the way President Trump did, correct?
No.
That giant signature that Trump had, right.
So maybe he should.
Well, and it'll be interesting to see, and perhaps taking a lessons learned from the Obama administration. Emily, I'll put this to you. One of the criticisms was that President Obama did not promote the stimulus plan of more than 12 years ago, or I guess for about 12 years ago. And it seems the Biden administration is going to do this differently.
Yeah, it definitely does seem like they want to talk about it. This is something that is out there. And they do have the favor that stimulus checks have almost become like a meme in a way. Like you hear people talking about the stimmies and the stimulus checks. And so I think that they are going to be very loud about this. But like truly, I've had people being like, when am I getting my check? When am I getting my check? Mm-hmm. So I think some of the work is also being done for them.
And it's called a stimmy, just so we're up on the lingo here.
That's what the Gen Z calls it, which I'm not, but.
And Lynn, it's popular, and who doesn't want a $1,400 check in the mail, correct?
I think it will be popular to send lots of people money. The polls suggest there's remarkable support for this program. Not just among Democrats, but 40 or more percent of Republicans say that they support getting money in the mail. But it's not a huge surprise, actually.
But given
how polarized things are, I guess it is kind of remarkable.
Something to bring everybody together, but also looking at some of the polling, and I'll put this to you, Lynn. I mean, it also looks like, beyond just wanting the money for themselves, that a lot of people are feeling like, the economy needs this. The local restaurant down the street, they need this. Schools need this, for instance.
Yeah. I mean, the restaurant industry has been decimated, and I think they'll be more directly affected by the programs aimed at trying to just keep them operating. But, demand for restaurants is going to surge after it becomes safe to go. The reason people have been going to restaurants is not because of government orders, but because they didn't want to die. And once it becomes safe to go there, not a threat to your health, people are going to be, there's going to be a lot of demand for doing things that weren't available during the recession. And that would have happened even without the stimulus checks, because a lot of people, as we noted, have been able to save a lot during the recession. And the stimulus checks will just expand that. The other thing is, I assume people will be purchasing consumer durables, replacing their cars or buying a new dishwasher or washing machine, or going on trips, which is something they haven't been able to do. Mm. So people will find ways to spend this money.
But do you think, picking up on that, that vaccines will do more for the American economy than the American Rescue Plan, Lynn?
The vaccines were the critical thing that had to happen. The economy was never going to get back to full steam while workers were at risk, being in contact with other people. And when, I don't have to elaborate on that. We've all experienced it.
Sure, sure. But I mean, it's just interesting to sort of see these, two things in kind of parallel, that hopefully will fix a number of the problems that many Americans have been dealing with. Emily, let me go back to you. We haven't talked about state and local governments. We haven't talked about schools. Looking at this rescue plan, what's in it for them?
So there is about $350 billion for state and local governments. This has been a really big sticking point between Democrats and Republicans. Democrats were pushing for this much of last year, and Republicans would not go for it. Now, I do know that some people will say some states are in a better situation than we thought they would be, and maybe this money would be better spent elsewhere. But it's also not a blue state bailout. There are states that are struggling that are red states, including Texas and Florida. Sure. And so I think that's important to note. And then there is a lot of money in here for schools, about $130 billion for K-12, and then about another $40 billion for higher education. And we know that schools have been, again, a huge issue throughout the pandemic in terms of can kids go to school safely and how. And I think it's important to point out that about 20% of funding for K through 12 needs to go toward learning loss, which basically means kind of making up for this lost ground. And so I think there's a sense that we need to make schools safer, obviously, get them operating, but also acknowledge what has happened over the past year to a lot of kids who have either not been in school or been trying to learn remotely or whatever their local setup is.
And that is good news. Here's Nancy asks, and I'll put this to you, Lynn. Many Republican speakers in the debate shouted about, quote, trillions left over from last year's stimulus. What are they talking about? What was that money targeted for? Is there money left over? And is it difficult to spend $1.9 trillion?
So I'm not really an expert on the money that's left over. I think it is difficult to spend $1.9 trillion. One of the big tests for the Biden administration is going to be whether the various government agencies can actually disperse the funds that they've been authorized and monitor them in such a way that there aren't like huge, you know, they can prevent fraud and things like that. The bill does have a lot of money, particularly I think for the IRS to try to and other agencies to try to make sure to try to limit fraudulent activity, but it's going to be a huge challenge.
Here's an email comment from Anthony. He says, "I find it interesting that the main focus is on the soon to sign COVID relief bill on today's panel is the cost, but hardly mention of the big tax cut. You can't have it both ways. Both contribute to the national debt." Can I toss that back to you, Len?
Yeah, so actually most of this bill is on the tax side. And I think it's like I looked at the numbers earlier. It was like out of the $1.9 trillion, like $1.2 or $1.3 trillion is changes in revenues, including increases in those refundable tax credits for low-income households. So it's one of the things, from my perspective as a tax specialist, this is probably this epitomizes how much we've moved the social safety net to the tax code.
Right. I mean, is that more like what Europe does, or are we sort of moving in that direction?
I don't think so. I mean, I think Europeans are a lot more comfortable just spending money.
Right.
One reason why a lot of the European economies have had to put less into their economic stimulus bills is that they already have a robust safety net that cushions the blow when the economy goes into a recession. Whereas our safety net, were it not for the changes enacted in the last year, would have completely crumbled. People would have lost their unemployment benefits, 10 months ago. The unemployment benefits themselves were way inadequate to actually meeting households' needs, and it would have been a disaster.
Emily, we have just about 5 or 6 more minutes, and I want to make sure that we can't cover everything in this relief package, but if there are any things in here that you think our listeners should know about that we haven't talked about, are we missing anything here?
I mean, I do think one thing in here that is neat is this student debt tax forgiveness, which is a little bit wonky, but basically what the bill does is that it says any student loans forgiven through 2025 would not be counted towards taxable income. And so part of that, obviously, is kind of to nudge Joe Biden to forgive student debt, which many Democrats in Congress have called on him to do, including Elizabeth Warren and Chuck Schumer. But this is something that, and Len probably knows quite a bit more about this, but that a lot of advocates on student debt have been pushing for a long time, because there are people on other student debt forgiveness programs for whom it would be taxable if and when their debt is forgiven, namely people on income-based repayment plans. And a lot of those plans aren't about to come up in the next 4 years, because a lot of the time it takes 20 years of making payments before your payments are forgiven. But I do think that a lot of student diasporas hope that this will stick, because otherwise what we're going to see is people having their debts forgiven and having a huge tax bill.
Well, and that's the question I think, Len, you raised, or the issue you raised at the top of the hour, which is a lot of what's in this bill is temporary. And the question is, once people get used to it, will it become permanent?
I think the Democrats clearly hope that that's the case, that people aren't going to want to see their child tax credit reduced in 2022. All of these other, but the Affordable Care Act, the subsidies for the ACA have been expanded massively, mostly just for a year. And they're hoping, I think, that there will be a broad bipartisan, among voters, bipartisan consensus that a lot of these things are things that they'd like to be in the structure that built into the law on a permanent basis. But I think it's going to be harder next year if the economy is doing well to argue that we should be borrowing a lot more money. So then you get into the tougher issue, which is how you pay for it.
And that's an election year, just to sort of add to, add to the drama there. Here's an email from Jill. Emily, this says, any plans to repeal or make changes to the Republican tax law? As a middle-income family, our tax burden increased significantly. All the stimulus so far, as well as most of the pending one, will go right back to the IRS for back taxes. Rather infuriating. Is that Republican tax law, as she calls it, does it have a sunset provision in it?
I think that is one where Democrats are steering a little bit clear of that. I would imagine she might be in a state that where she's affected by like the state and local tax stuff, I would guess. But I don't know like how much that is really on the agenda right now. I think it's something that's sort of being discussed, but it's not super open, at least in my impression, about what to do about that 2017 bill.
How about for you, Len?
Well, so when candidate Biden was running for office, he had proposed a number of things that would have modified the 2017 legislation, including rolling back a lot of the tax cuts for high income people and increasing taxes in some cases for people with very high incomes. Because of that reconciliation process that Emily talked about, the whole bill expires most of it expires after 2025. So at some point we have to revisit that legislation. I don't think anybody right now is talking about tax increases in the middle of a recession, but when the economy is doing healthy again, when the economy is back at full health, I think that will be part of the discussion, presumably part of the debate in 2022.
Len, is there a short answer to Ron's question? Why should the U.S. government subsidize low wages so that executives can pay themselves multi-million dollar salaries? Is there a short answer to that?
No, but that subsidizing wages for people who can't, who basically don't have the skills or don't live in a place where they can earn enough to support themselves, I think is actually a good idea. And I don't think the alternative is either you don't subsidize their wages, and millionaires won't get benefits anymore, or you do subsidize it and they won't. I think they're. The issues are really not connected with each other.
Well, we have to leave it there. My thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. And Len Berman, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Marty.
And you're very welcome. And he's an economist, co-founder of the Tax Institute. Emily Stewart, thank you for joining us as well. She's a reporter for Fox. Thanks, Emily.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you for joining us.